Jason. Good morning, Northgate. Thank you so much for having me back. You guys were so gracious last week. I love being here with this church. Right after preaching last Sunday, we actually, my husband and I, we left town and headed out to Yosemite with our own church staff for just a short retreat time up in the mountains. We had 4 days of hammocks, card games, hikes, campfires, and endless snacks with 9 other leaders and pastors from our church, and it was heavenly. One of the evenings up there, we had all gone through a core values training together, and it reminds me a lot of the core values I see displayed in your welcome area in the church. And we did this, you know, determining what are the core values in our own lives individually that drive us and help us to make decisions. So in this training, everyone was going through a card deck. The deck had about 250 different cards, all with different value words on them, like faith, hope, creativity, health, generosity, impact. And the goal of the card deck is to be able to choose 4 words out of that 250 that defined your personal core values, with the intention that this would hopefully provide a lot of self-awareness, clarity, giving you the ability to define your win and to set good boundaries and to sacrifice with even better intention. And so it really was an enlightening practice to go through this as a group, right? Go through a deck of cards, discover which words felt most important to each of us, and then to watch the similarities in our group and some of the differences in unique words. And many of us chose very biblical values, right? There was love and faith and grace and hope. And then a lot of us also chose words that were personal, like more tied to our personality or our experiences, like adventure, wonder, humility, and reliability. And it made it very easy to see how different our values are because of the experiences that we've gone through. But each of us had at least one value word that we picked to describe how we connect with others. For some, that word was actually connection. For someone else in our group, that word was curiosity. A few people actually chose the word love. Someone else chose kindness, but my word was belonging, which is so full of story for me because for much of my life, I have sought belonging with groups of people, which I believe just comes from a need that I think we all have to be known and to be loved. So there have been many times in my life when my desire to belong was actually bigger in my life than my desire to please God or to honor myself in my boundaries. And so I would sometimes find belonging in some really harmful and unhealthy ways, especially throughout my 20s, because I was trying desperately to find connection. And so last Sunday together, we were building a biblical case for the attunement and the care that our bodies and brains need in order to soothe our search for safety and belonging. This need for others, this need to belong, it is primal. For millennia, this has actually protected us, this instinct to physically protect mankind from all sorts of danger, from dinosaurs to cowboys to captivity, famine, and world wars. And so we've always needed the security of community to survive. And in our modern world, especially in our Western culture, physical safety may not feel like it's that big of a deal to us anymore, but emotional safety definitely is. See, our brains, we are constantly scanning situations and interactions for possible harm and pitfall. Our brains are determining, most of the time without our actual consent, just how emotionally available we're going to be in any given situation. And so each and every time that you have experienced harm at the hand of other humans, your brain has learned something about that interaction to avoid in the future. So as children, we learn to study the faces, body language of the adults and the caregivers around us in order to intuit whether we are safe and whether we are good. And a lot of times we will... we will connect these feelings, this safety and this goodness to the responses of our caregivers, to some of our actions, the way that we serve them, the way that we meet their needs and their expectations, resulting in us learning that a lot of our connections in life are transactional, and that often they are dependent on what we can earn or what we can offer. And so this is often what starts to bind our mind to these lies, lies that we'll continue to believe about ourselves or about connection with others, unless we are able to receive good care and attunement that we need in order to help loosen our grip on these counterfeit connection points. And each generation has their own perversion or counterfeit of connection that they'll offer. For many of us, we feel connected because of all the knowledge that we have about others. But without intimacy and safety, most of our connections are honestly just device deep, right? And God feels far. Others feel scary. And for most of us, we don't really know what we think, feel, or need. And over time, we become more and more closed off. The survival mode parts of our brain that we talked about last week, these start to get activated as if we're in physical harm from a lack of safe connection. These render us almost powerless to the demands of our coping strategies and our unmet needs, like for belonging and safety. And this is why so many of us get stuck in patterns where we are settling for harm in our lives. Addiction, shame, separation from others. When we're in situations in life, when we're continuing a cycle of harm, putting ourselves in situations with people where we are repeating patterns that are either harmful for ourselves with others, your brain is likely attempting to get a need met through the wrong avenues. It's like what Paul writes in Romans 7:15. He says, I don't understand why I act the way that I do. I don't do what I know is right, and I do the things that I hate. But what is incredibly beautiful and restorative about the way that God created our brains to function is that they are malleable. They can change over time. So when you encounter people who carry the mantle of sanctuary spaces, like we're going to talk about today, the kind of people who are vessels of God's good care, your brain will release the chemicals that allow you to open up, releasing some of those closed-off spaces that hold stories of harm. And it is by intentional and repeated practices of good care and attunement that our connection with God, with ourselves, and with others begins to get healed. It's the reason why talking to a therapist or a trusted friend who is good at curiosity can be so helpful, because our brains are wired to heal through attunement. And so last week we talked about how all of us were made for connection. Connection is one of the most transformational substances that we have available to us here on this earth. God created us for it, created us in it, he modeled it for us, and he provided connection with others as a means to disciple and transform us. So we're going to review really quick just some of the points that we talked about in Genesis together. Number one is that God is community, and he created us to mirror him. We saw this in Genesis 1:26, which says, "Let us make man in our image." Number two is that God created us with needs designed to be met by others. We saw this together in Genesis 2:18, when God says, "It is not good for man to be alone, so let's make a helper for him." And then number three is that God created community to disciple us and to make us perfect in his love. We read this together in 1 John 4:12, which says, "No one has ever seen God, but if we love each other, God lives in us and his love is brought to full expression in us." So we were created by community, in community, and for community. And God's design is that you would actually be matured and discipled in community. God believes in connection so much that he actually allows layers of his love and healing to be hidden inside of others. And it's part of our transformation process to meet the needs of others and then also to invite them in to meet our own emotional needs as well. And yet most of us here in North America, we are so comfortable, we are so self-reliant and isolated from vulnerability. We read last week even in 1 Peter 2:5 that we are called to be sanctuary spaces, temples, safe and holy places where God's Spirit can dwell and where others' stories can be tended to. And we cannot offer to the world what we don't already have established with God and ourselves. And so the four questions that I positioned to us last week were this: how do we become safe spaces for others? How do we become a safe space for ourselves? And does God feel safe to you? And if he doesn't, for some reason, feel safe, then how do we heal this? To answer all of those questions, I want to take us this morning to a pretty famous story. I'm sure you've read it many times, about Jesus using attunement as a means to communicate his love and offer healing to a woman on the outskirts of society. So this is in John, the Gospel of John, so near the beginning of the Old Testament, and we're going to be looking in chapter 4, starting just in verses 1 through 8. We won't read them all together this morning, but I do want you to just have access to this passage as a reference as we're talking through some of the events that are happening here. Jesus, he's talking to a woman who was outcasted from her community because of marital problems. Jesus asked her to go get him a drink from the well. And we read this in modern context and think it's really no big deal. But to them, for him to have asked her was definitely a big deal. Look at verse 9. The Bible is very specific to point out that other religious Jews would have never spoken to this woman directly, not in the daylight, at least. That was forbidden. And what I love about this exchange between him and her is that this woman doesn't shrink back or cower at all to Jesus' request for water. In fact, she answers back to him, "You aren't supposed to be talking to me," which is basically her way of asking, "But what do you really want?" And then Jesus begins to share the gospel with her, sharing about a living water that will quench her thirst completely and make it so that she will never be thirsty again. And in John chapter 4, verse 15, we see that she doesn't understand him or believe him quite yet. They are standing in front of an actual well of water, and she thinks that Jesus is literally talking about that water still. And so she calls his bluff pretty sarcastically and brilliantly. And she asks Jesus to give her this living water so that she can stop wasting her time walking to the well every day. And she says this with so much sass. And I really do believe that Jesus loved her honesty and attitude in that moment. And it's right here that Jesus says, "What I used to believe was one of the coldest and baddest burns of the Bible. Jesus is funny sometimes. But before I began reading the words of Jesus in the context of his goodness and kindness, I would read things and think, wow, Jesus, what are you doing? Like, that feels kind of rude right there." I'll explain to you what I mean. This is John chapter 4, verse 16. Jesus says, "Go and get your husband." Verse 17, "I don't have a husband," the woman replied. Jesus says, "You're right. You don't have a husband. You have had 5 husbands, and the man that you're living with now, you are not even married to." Burn. Like, why did he have to go and get into her business like this at the public well? Can you even imagine, though, sharing about God's love with someone that you have never met before? Someone on the street that you run into and speaking to them this way? Like, have you ever read this story and wondered, what is actually happening in this exchange? What is Jesus' posture toward this woman? Because when I read this text through my own humanity, through my own emotional and human slant, it honestly just sounds kind of rude to me. And so sometimes I have to choose to make the conscious effort to read the Bible through the lens that Jesus is loving and kind. This is where our perspective of the character of God will affect how we read his word. Because he doesn't operate in shame. And sarcasm is actually not a fruit of the Spirit. So, I know. I wish it was too. But when we know, this statement could not have been meant to shame her. And I believe it is also imperative to read this interaction through the lens of understanding what she has been through in her life. You see, this is a Samaritan woman in a town that was recently taken over by Roman rule. And Jesus approaches a woman that is deemed culturally dirty and unworthy just because of who she is. She's been given this label by the Jews for how she was born into this world. And she's been given this label by her own community for how she's lived her life. And all of the failed marriages that she's had. Failures that she certainly does carry with her. But also, it's important to know that culturally, this woman would not have been able to initiate a single one of those divorces on her own. It just wasn't even legal for a woman to divorce her husband. And so, if I'm being completely transparent, before I understood this context, I would blow through these scriptures, and I used to quickly read this passage and just make the assumption that this is a story of a sexually promiscuous chick who could not keep a man. And maybe that's why Jesus spoke to her so harshly. How pretentious, right? Do you hear the contempt in this assumption? She must have done something wrong to deserve harsh treatment. As if the Son of God would openly shame us when we are struggling. Reading the Bible through the lens of an angry God is certainly a first sign that something is off in your connections with him. So back to the Samaritan woman. If she had actually been unfaithful to a single one of her husbands, she would have been stoned to death by now, because that's what the law was. A man could divorce his wife for even the slightest of offenses, and essentially he would just return her back to her father so that he could be responsible for her again. And we read that this woman has had 5 husbands and is now living with a new man that she's not married to yet. And so the question exists, where is her family? Why is she estranged from them? What happened there? Because here she is, en route already for her 6th marriage, and I have to wonder what it might have required of this woman to survive 5 husbands in a world that sees her life as expendable. Can you read in between the lines of the text that this woman is existing within a multi-layered reality of trauma? You can be absolutely sure that loss and abuse was a part of this woman's story. And so when Jesus brings up her past, he is not calling her out, he is calling her in. He's saying, I see you, I see what you've had to endure to try to find safety and belonging. Jesus is seeing her and naming her all of her. He is neither her accuser nor her excuser. And he sweeps nothing under the rug. He doesn't throw stones, but he will leave no stone left unturned. And so Jesus recognizes that she lives her life in this desperate search for belonging, to be known and to be loved, but has also had very real needs for protection and survival. And in all of the relationships that she has ever sought that through, she's been expendable, replaceable. So as a means of protection, she's become walled off and isolated. How do we know this? Well, she was at the well at noon, for starters. Look at John 4:6. Why does the writer take the time to point out that it's noon? Because women didn't go to the well at noon. This was a practice that was typically done early in the morning and again in the evening. She was there at noon probably because she was avoiding people. Her shame was keeping her walled off from having healthy relationships, just like in the garden with Adam and Eve. Just like the original sin when they hid and they covered up. She was at the well in the middle of the day because she didn't want to see the other women of the town. She didn't want to hear any more snickering about her life. She didn't want to see the stares and the false sympathy. And so when Jesus meets her and he breaks every social rule in order to have a conversation with her, it does make sense why her responses are defensive and sarcastic. This woman has become an expert at avoiding social interactions. I know this because I also excel at this art form. And the last thing that you want to happen when you are purposely avoiding people that you know is to strike up a conversation with a stranger when you're just trying to fill your water jug. It is why the good people at the grocery stores created self-checkout lines. God bless them. And so he offers her living water. He tells her that a relationship with God will be so fulfilling and refreshing that it will stop her from searching for safety and belonging from other sources. See, he's not just offering her a ticket to heaven when she dies. I think a lot of times we can mistakenly be invited to act as if God just wants salvation for us, like that's all there is. He's telling her about the good news of being known and loved by the Father right now. He is wooing her back to Eden with him, back to connection. He's inviting her into a relationship with the Spirit, and so he calls her bluff. He points out that the way she's been trying to get her needs met are just not working anyways, and so what does she really have to lose? She's been stuck in this lifestyle of unmet needs, shame, and abandonment. Unmet needs, shame, and abandonment, and it's left her broken and hurting, and so in this one single conversation with a Savior, Jesus tells her how seen she is. He offers her a better way. He invites her to surrender her shame in exchange for connection. But the truth is, she needed to be seen that day before she could surrender. We try to skip past this part because it kind of hurts. The reckoning of all that has transpired to bring us to this point of wading through your past experiences with the Savior at the city well. She was in survival mode. And Jesus sought her out to change her story through attunement, curiosity, and good care. And the reason why Jesus brought up her marriages and her living situation was because she actually needed to know that he wasn't going to abandon her once he found them out. She needed to know that Jesus really knew her before she could believe that he really loved her. Because to be known and not loved is one of our greatest fears. But to be loved and not really known, like, that is just a vapid existence, and that really can't meet our internal needs either. Many of us believe that if you really knew me, there's no way you would love me. And so we keep our true selves guarded, sometimes even in our closest friendships. We refuse to let anyone know who we really are, because being known feels scary when our brains are physically stuck in survival mode. And we can't just turn this response off by our will or our obedience. And so for whatever reason, when we aren't able to receive attunement that we need from the people that are closest to us, we can go about trying to achieve this in different ways. Through compromises and compensating, through seeking to numb our senses, which a lot of times can be really harmful to us. And this is what Jesus means when he says that he can give us water that will make us never thirst again. He means that he is our source of fulfillment. He means that with him at the center of our souls, we will never search for our worth in unreliable sources. And so, as a result of their conversation, this Samaritan woman, she runs back to the town where she came from, and she tells everyone about the man that she met at the well, and she describes him like this. This is in John 4:39, and this is the Message translation. She says, "He knew all about the things I did. He knows me inside and out." John 4:39. But it's not just that he knew her, right? Because everyone knew her. She was quite famous. The whole town would wade through her dirty laundry on a daily basis. She was not very high esteemed. The difference here is that Jesus knew her, and he was kind to her. He knew everything she had done, everything she had experienced, everything that had happened to her, every poor decision she ever made or that happened to her. And he didn't make her feel ashamed. In fact, he gave her something that would cancel that shame out for her. He offered her a way out of the broken loop that she had been stuck in for years. And what Jesus does is he bends down to the earth with us, often through other people, and he wants to patiently sort through these things that are blocking us off from connection with him. My regret, my sin, the traumatic or confusing experiences I've been through as a result of other people's sin. And as we sit together in silence, just me and him, it's a worshipful act of intimacy to let him see the things that I've kept hidden, to show him the burdens that I carry, and to let him tell me how loved and accepted I really am, and that I don't have to carry this weight anymore. He knows me fully, and yet he loves me fully. And just like the Samaritan woman now, we are all free to run and exclaim, "Come and meet the man who knew all the things I ever did and still loves me." This is the exchange he's offering all of us. His love and attention, this connection, it's transformational. And we are called to carry this type of love into the world with us. We are called to carry this mantle of connection that we can bear with God, to be vessels of living water, to be beacons of light like Matthew 5 talks about as we go out into the world. We all have different sources in our lives that we go to when we need a recharge, when we need nourishment, when we need refreshment, care, comfort, even those times when we need to numb out. We go to some sort of source to meet those needs. That's what this well represents. For many of us, the well of connection to God, the well of living water, has seemed to run dry at different points in our life. It's not because God's cut us off. It's usually because of the debris that exists in our own lives. There is something else down in the well that is blocking us from accessing that living water. There's often something blocking us from believing that God can really love us. So we either deal with the dryness or we go to other wells, sometimes puddles, to get those needs met. And oftentimes, this causes a lot more heartbreak for us. But Jesus, he offers the Samaritan woman the living water. He promises that it is water that satisfies. He offers her water from a well that will not run dry and that cannot be stopped up. And what he's doing in her story is he begins to dig with her, right? He is digging up the blockages in her life. He's offering to clear the well, to reestablish this connection with himself. And I see him do this in my own life. He offers to exchange my attempts at behavior modification or coping skills for his heart of true transformation. And it is a literal renewing of the mind, just like in Romans 12:2, which says, "Don't be like the people of this world, but let God change the way that you think. Then you will know how to do everything that is good and pleasing to him." And God does this by digging with us. He does this by sorting through the harm from our past, not excusing it, not ignoring it. And it actually really matters that we take the time to do this with him and that we do not bypass our pain. Because, guys, whatever we dismiss, whatever we bypass and choose to stuff down to ignore, it gets left in the well. And so it seems to muddy up our connection with God and our connection to ourselves and eventually even our connection with others. Jesus wants to dig through what has been stuffed in the well and reestablish connection and attunement by helping us to see that we have always been fully known and fully loved by him. He restores honor and dignity back to our stories that aren't really full of honor and dignity. And this well of living water, this serves as our sanctuary space. This serves as this well of peace, of safety, and belonging. It's a conduit for connection for every other relationship in our lives. And it's a holy place. And we have the opportunity of investing in this work, but first we have to do it for ourselves. We are meant to pour out from a deep well of connection with a good and kind Father who loves us. And so I want to ask us today, what might be blocking up your well? What's gotten in the way of connection with God? What's gotten in the way of seeing him as a good Father who loves you, who seeks connection with you? Because if you see God as an angry parent who is waiting for you to mess up, to slap you upside the head, something harmful might be stuck in the well. If you see God as a controlling boss, impossible to please, expecting you to fix the things in your life that seem wrong before he will reestablish connection with you, then something is stuck in the well. If you are seeing God as distant, as manipulative, as abusive, or uninterested, something else is stuck in the well. That connection is being muddied by past experiences. And what do we do in this situation? Well, we want to get alone. We want to follow the lie. We withhold judgment. We get curious, bravely naming our emotions and their needs as they arise. And we surrender those to God. And we ask him to help us trust him. Asking good questions about when you first remember this feeling, when you first felt this lie ring true in your brain, and then resist judging yourself for the conclusions that you've made. And this is how we let Jesus dig down to the bottom of this blockage with us. And we actually need a lot of safety in order to be able to do this work. And there are often layers to this healing. Oftentimes, a story will pop up for me from my childhood, a story that maybe I thought was already dealt with and healed, and different layers, different sides and facets get exposed of past pain. And all you have to do is sit back down with God, submit this to him, these feelings. And he is willing to be so patient with you. But we've got to be willing to mourn our losses in order to experience his joy. We know this from scripture. Psalm 126, 5 and 6 says, "Those who plant in tears will harvest with shouts of joy. They weep as they go plant their seed, but they sing as they return with a harvest." Worship team, you can go ahead and come back up. Lead us in some worship songs as we close today. I believe that God honors how deep into the well we are willing to go with him, because his love is actually perfect for us. So he can love us at every level that we're at. Remember that he stands at the door knocking, right? He's not barging his way in. He is willing to go at your pace. And the truly exciting part, the part that makes all of this work worth it, this work is what points us to be able to live out our own unique mission. This deep personal work is for every single one of us, and it will likely open your eyes to how God wants to partner with you in this world, because our own righteous anger for our abuse often becomes an anthem for the justice and freedom of others. Our deepest pain points become a breeding ground for the healing and the restoration of those that we are called to serve and to love and to lead. So the benefit of this work is that a well might take years to dig, right? But once that work is established, it continues to pour out, serving the entire community. Wells take years to dig, but only moments to pour out. So digging a well might seem like backbreaking labor. What I'm asking you to sit with Jesus and dig up in your life is not easy work. Please care for yourselves in this practice. And once you establish that transformational connection with Jesus, you now have a source of fresh water in your life to pour out from. And we are all called to pour out. We are all leaders in this work. So we don't have to pour out from these stopped up cisterns, these shallow puddles that we've been living from, but from the living well. And so I ask you today, church, will you dig in? Will you trust God to be in charge of the healing that you need? We are invited to go inward, to find those dark places that have caused harm, to ask Jesus to illuminate them and to let him tend to those needs. And this is actually what offers us hope, because we were created for connection and attunement with God, to be known by him. You were created to be loved by him and to be a beacon of hope for others. So let's dig in. Thank you, church.